This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning and this is The Breakfast Grill. Hated maths at school, confused by numbers and puzzled by statistics? Join the club, but in the age of big data and algorithms, should we view statistics as a trick or a tool? To help us answer that question and also maybe to overcome our fear of stats, we have on the line a self-confessed data detective and author of a recently published book, How to Make the World Add Up, Tim Harford, with us this morning. Thank you for joining us again. You were last here on the show in June 2018. So let me start by asking how you came up with these 10 rules plus one golden one in your new book on how we should look at this bewildering world of stats.
Sure. Well, I've been presenting on the BBC World Service for now nearly 15 years, a programme about the numbers that surround us and how to think about them. And so I thought I've learned enough to try to write a book to help people. But this is not a book about how to think about statistics. This is a book about how to think clearly about the world. My argument is simply that there are certain things that we can't see, we can't perceive without some help from the statistics. They are a vital tool. And so the rules are generally not highly technical. They're not the rules that you would learn if you took a statistics class. They're rules about how we think, what our filters are, what our biases are, and how to put numbers into context and really use them to help us think more clearly about the world.
Yeah, Tim, I would have to say under normal circumstances, I would never pick up a book on statistics unless I was studying for an exam. But this book is extremely readable, all 350 pages of it. I read it from cover to cover. But to help this conversation along, I want to pick out on some of the rules which actually interest me and perhaps throw in some recent events to highlight the usefulness of your rules. So let's start with rule one, feelings trump expertise. Now, I struggle with this a little bit because you tell us that we have bias and sometimes we want to be fooled. But we're human beings, right? So how do we hold our bias in check and control those emotions?
I think the simple answer is that we need to notice our own biases. We need to notice our own emotions. The book begins, in fact, the first chapter begins with a story about an expert fooling himself. And this is not a story about statistics. It's actually a story about an art forgery. It's an amazing story, I have to say, an astonishingly crude forgery that fooled one of the world's great experts. But why was he fooled? He actually wrote an essay about this forgery that took him in. He didn't know it was a forgery. He wrote, "When I saw this masterpiece, I had difficulty controlling my emotion." Well, I mean, that's the problem right there. He had difficulty controlling his emotion. The fake painting he was being shown played into his hopes, his aspirations about the particular painter in question and what that painter had done. What he was being shown was not a forgery, but he was being shown proof that he was right all along. And what he failed to do was to notice how excited he was, how overwhelmed he was. Now, when we think about our own situation, when we read newspaper headlines, we listen to the radio, watch the TV, we click on social media, a lot of what we see is designed to provoke an emotional reaction. It's designed to make us angry or excited or joyful or vindicated, to show that our side is right and the other side is wrong, they're wicked. And what we need to do is not ignore those emotions, but to notice them, to be very clear that the headline, the claim, the social media post is producing an emotional reaction. And once we notice that, immediately we're able to be a little bit calmer and to think more clearly. I know it's weird. It sounds like mindfulness meditation only for statistics, but it really works.
Yeah, but on the flip side, right, when we are confronted with data or news story that we are not happy to read, that it doesn't fall into our line of thinking, we want to underestimate it. And I think this is something you highlighted in the recent FT column. So I'm going to use COVID-19 pandemic as an example. How do we not get trapped into only wanting to focus on data that we want to see?
It is a risk all the time. There's one study that I describe in the book, asking people to just make forecasts of what's going to happen to the price of wheat. And they're paid more money if they make a good forecast. But they're also divided into two groups. One group are paid extra money if the price of wheat is low, and one group are paid money if the price of wheat is high. They say, oh, you guys are the farmers and you guys are the bakers. And what people found, what the research has found, is that people's forecasts, even though they were being paid to produce an accurate forecast, their forecasts were swayed by what they wished to be true. So they saw the world through the lens of what they wanted. And so we just need to recognize that. In the case of COVID, certainly here in the UK, people have very quickly adopted sides. There's a group of people who want stricter restrictions. They want the government to take more action, to lock down hard, to prevent the spread of the disease. And there are other people who think the disease is overblown. We should be free to do what we want. They often say masks don't work. They often say that the death count is overrated. And both of these sides have some good points. But if you are purely focusing on trying to win an argument, you're looking only for the data that supports you, and you reject the data that is unfortunate for your argument or which makes you feel threatened, then you're not being able to think clearly. I always find I look for people on social media who are trying to understand the world. I'm not so interested in following people who are trying to win an argument. And the same is true for me. It's fine to try to win an argument. It's fine to try to persuade people. But that comes later. First, understand what is going on. Understand the world. Then you can get into an argument if you want.
And then I want to look at rule two, ponder your personal experience. So you're suggesting that we take this bird's eye view of statistics and combine that with our own personal experience. But the pitfall of that is sometimes the stats can be misleading, or our own views misleading, or even both, right? So how do we avoid this then?
Yes, well, that's why you need both, because one of the things that you gain is an extra check if the statistics are painting the wrong picture, or maybe your personal experience is painting the wrong picture. You rely on both. And you try to, I think, put in the effort and to be motivated to learn from both. One of the points that I make in the book is when you go to a place, maybe you travel to a far-off country, or you're investigating a social problem and you meet people who are really experiencing that problem. So say, for example, you're investigating hunger and people who are going hungry. Well, you really need to understand where that's coming from. You need to meet people who suffer from food insecurity. So you can have that personal experience. That's very rich. It's very detailed. There's a lot of information, a lot of subtle insight that you pick up from having personal discussions with people who are affected or experiencing something yourself. On the other hand, when you think about the information you get from statistics, it's much thinner. It's much less informative in some ways. But in other ways, it tells you so much more. Because a statistic can tell you about hunger all over the world. 8 billion people can tell you who is hungry. It can give you an unbiased perspective. It's not just who you happen to meet. It's not just where you happen to go. Maybe if you're visiting a foreign country, not just the place that tourists go, but the statistics can reach everywhere. So you're gaining something very different from the statistics and from your personal perspective. And the trouble is, very often people try to choose one or another. They only trust their gut. They only trust their personal experience. Or people who are maybe a little bit more mathematically confident, they only trust the data. They only trust what's in the spreadsheet. But both of those pictures are incomplete. And if you want wisdom, you try to combine the two. And when the two seem to conflict, well, that should be the start of asking questions. Why am I learning something different from the data that I learned from my personal experience? How can I resolve the apparent conflict? And then you really start learning about the world, which, of course, is what my book is all about. It's about thinking more clearly about how the world is.
Yeah, which I think makes rule number four even more meaningful, right? Because it asks you to step back and enjoy the view of the world, I guess. But the problem is, in new media, we are particularly guilty of this because we always want to push out a story. Quick, break that story today. I mean, who still enjoys long reads now? And your suggestion of going deeper and broader rather than faster seems almost like a lost cause, though. I mean, especially since some people I know get only news from social media.
Well, I think there are two different things going on there. One is the focus just on what happened in the last 5 minutes, in the last hour, in the last day, and not saying what happened over the last 6 months, what happened over the last 10 years. Can I put what's happening in my country in context by looking at what's happening in a different country? That sort of long view is, I think, incredibly informative, and it's really important to get that. Now, what you're suggesting is social media is very bad at that. Yes and no. Social media, I think, really expands the range of what is possible. So if you want to get very excited, very angry, you want to form judgments very fast and share those judgments instantly without thinking, well, social media is great for that, of course. But at the same time, if you really want a range of perspectives, if you want to find out what the experts are saying in a timely way, really going deep, well, you can find that on social media as well. I find on Twitter, for example, there is a huge range of epidemiologists now tweeting very informative stuff about COVID. All the graphs, all the links, all the sources. And you can see it's like stepping into an academic seminar and watching these people discuss with each other. And of course, they've learned to express their views clearly to the rest of us as well. So I think a lot of it is about the motivation. Do you want to think clearly? Do you want to understand the truth? Or do you want to get angry and participate in an argument? I think social media makes it easier to do both.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning, we have Tim Harford, author of the recently published book, How to Make the World Add Up. Up next, how do we avoid statistics from being misused by governments? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. This morning, we have Tim Harford, author of the recently published book, How to Make the World Add Up, and also presenter of Radio 4's More or Less program, which is centered on debunking statistics and numbers. I want to jump some of the rules and move to rule 6. Ask who's missing. We should be asking what is not included in the data gathering that might change the outcome. Now, to me, the topic that comes to mind, of course, are polls. And the recent ones that have been so wrong include the 2016 US presidential elections and, of course, Brexit. All so wrong. So how reliable are they?
So the polls, why are the polls wrong? I should say in both of those cases, the polls were not very wrong. They just happened to be on the wrong side of a very important question. But one of the reasons why opinion polls can be wrong is that you're missing certain groups of people who don't want to talk to you or who are hard to find. So for example, in the case of the Trump-Clinton election in 2016, it turns out that for some reason, Trump voters were underrepresented in the polls. Either they didn't want to talk to the opinion pollsters, or the opinion pollsters in their sampling methods weren't able to find them. And that was one reason why all the polls were just slightly skewed towards Clinton. And it wasn't a big effect. It didn't take much. And then when the election was held, Trump is doing 2 or 3 points better, and that's enough to make a difference in the swing states. So this problem is, of course, quite well understood by opinion pollsters, but it's not necessarily easy to fix. I mean, you know that there is somebody out there who you're missing, somebody who's not talking to you, but you can never be sure who they are. And you can try to make adjustments. And then sometimes, of course, you make over-adjustments. So this year, of course, everyone is very interested again. Will it be Trump again or will it be Biden? And the opinion pollsters have made all sorts of adjustments to their polls in order to try to avoid the mistake they made last time. But have they done enough? Maybe they've done too much. Maybe Biden will win by more than we expect. Or maybe there'll be a shock and Trump will win. It's hard to be sure. We can sometimes detect this after the fact. So, for example, in the UK, in the 2015 general election, the Conservative Party did quite a lot better than was expected. And the opinion pollsters thought the problem was a late swing. So at the last minute, people switched towards the Conservative Party, and that's why they won. So the solution, if that's right, is, oh, you conduct more quick polls, quick and dirty polls. They're not very good, but you do them right at the last minute, and you can pick up that swing. But later it turned out that that wasn't what happened. And we were able to figure that out by sending people knocking on doors and asking them how they voted. And the first time you send a bunch of people around knocking on doors to ask people how they voted, what you get was not the same answer as the election. You get the same answer as the polls, which were wrong. But you send people around again to the same houses and you ask again, and you ask again a third time, a fourth time. And gradually you find more conservative voters because it turns out they're more often out and they're more often not willing to speak to the pollsters. And finally, when they went back six times to the same houses, they finally got the same result as the actual general election. So it turns out conservative voters in that opinion poll had been missing. It's really hard to know how to fix this problem, but it's always out there threatening any opinion poll. And we always need to ask ourselves, who is missing? Who is not included? That's true, not just for opinion polls, but for any data that we're collecting. It's very easy to miss out certain kinds of groups. Women are often not reflected in the questions that are asked by opinion pollsters. They tend to be designed with a man in mind. Or you have marginalized groups, for example, homeless people tend not to show up on surveys at all. So it's very important to try to fix these gaps in the data that we collect.
And related to statistics is actually big data, right? And the use of algorithms. I think it's more prevalent than many of us realize, because whatever decisions we do, what we buy online, for example, what websites we read, that's all collated. And every large corporation, from the likes of Amazon to Facebook to Tesco and now TikTok, know the inherent value of data that is collected is actually worth more than its weight in gold. But should we be fearful of this?
I mean, the algorithms can be very useful, sure. But what we need, I think, is more scrutiny, particularly when algorithms are making really life-changing decisions. So algorithms are being used to decide, for example, if someone is suspected of a crime, should they go to prison before their trial or should they be allowed to walk free before their trial? Often it's an algorithm now that advises the judge before the judge makes that decision. Or in the UK, we had this extraordinary situation where, because of coronavirus, all the exams were cancelled. And the government said, oh, don't worry, we're going to have an algorithm, and the algorithm will decide what exams people get. Well, you can imagine how well that went. How can a computer, how can an algorithm give a fair grade for an exam that the student has never sat? So this is a problem because you have powerful people in the Justice Department, powerful people in government, being told that the algorithms are amazing and that the algorithms will solve difficult problems for them. But actually, these algorithms are not subject to scrutiny. They're not subject to proper testing. We don't have good evidence on when they work and when they don't. And so in my book, I argue it is a little bit like the history of science. In the 1600s, you had scientists also dabbling in alchemy. So they were trying to create the secret of eternal youth. They were trying to turn lead into gold. And the reason that these are the same men using the same methods, making amazing progress in science and making no progress in alchemy. And the reason is because they never shared their results with alchemy. It was always a secret. So nobody ever learned from anybody else's mistakes. Whereas with science, it was a culture of openness and collaboration and sharing. And so people learned really fast. And at the moment, I worry a little bit that the way we treat algorithms is very much the way we treat alchemy. It's all a secret because people want to make money, but that is no way to make scientific progress.
What do you think about privacy issues, though, in the search for statistics, because we give out data everywhere?
It's a huge issue. And I think we often say, oh, as long as the data is anonymized, it's fine. But in fact, even when data are anonymized, it can be very easy to figure out who, in fact, is concerned. One famous story about this was in Massachusetts in the United States. They passed a law releasing medical records, but they would all be anonymized. Okay, so you didn't know whose medical record was whose. But of course, there was enough information in the medical record, like the person's age, the number of children they had, their zip code, so where they lived. You could very quickly figure out who was who. And one privacy campaigner got the medical records of the governor of Massachusetts and mailed him his own medical records. In principle, anonymous. In practice, very easy to figure out who is who. So these are tough issues. They're not straightforward to solve. But there are clever ways that we can release data into the public domain so that everybody can use it and learn from it in a way that does help to preserve anonymity. We just need to be a bit more clever about how we do it.
Okay, then I want to move on to Rule 8, which is don't take statistical bedrock for granted. And I really enjoyed the examples used in this chapter since it involves government and does show the extent to which politicians will go to hide or suppress statistics which are unfavorable to them. But then how can we ensure that the statistics collected by governments are not going to be fiddled with, you know, and are kept real?
Yes. I mean, some of the stories of the persecution of certain statisticians are really terrifying. I mean, Mr. Georgiou was basically publishing the truth about the Greek economy and being accused of treason for telling the truth. And his case was repeatedly reinstalled and thrown out and reinstalled and thrown out by the Supreme Court. And there are other examples as well. And it reminds us, it can take some bravery to be an official statistician, or to stand up to powerful people who don't want to hear the truth. Of course, some official statistics will be distorted as a result. I think the more sort of established governance you have, the more transparency you have, and the more tradition of independent statistics you have, the more confident you can be in official statistics. I mean, there are people all over the world doing an amazing job gathering data to help us understand the world and to help us hold governments to account. So I think a lot of times governments think that the official statistics are just for them. They're like a management information system that lets them make decisions. But they're not just for governments. Those data are for everybody. And one of the things that we can do with those data is to know whether the government is doing a good job or not. I really think about the coronavirus pandemic. You think about all the scramble to understand what's going on. Where is this virus? How dangerous is it? How fast is it spreading? What's the R number? Who is most at risk? Coming to understand that elderly people are much more at risk than the young. What treatments are effective? How can we use them? How can we prove that a vaccine is safe and effective? All of these questions can only be answered by gathering really good, robust data. And there's been an extraordinary, almost heroic effort around the world to get this data. And one of the things I want people to understand is that this effort takes place all the time. Maybe the stakes are not always so high, but statisticians are always gathering data because they want to understand crime. They want to understand what's happening to the economy, to unemployment. They want to understand what's happening to our planet. These vital questions, we can only understand them with good data. There are people all around us trying to collect that data, and yet we take them for granted. We assume the numbers will always be there when we want them, and we joke about lies and statistics, and we only notice when things go wrong. And it's not fair. I think we really need to give statistics and statisticians more respect for the amazing job they do for us.
Yeah, I think that's really, really true in this COVID-19 era. And I think what's really interesting has been, like you say, the sharing of that information. On that note, thank you for your time today to remind us that stats can help us to see the world a little clearer, especially if we remember the rules. Joining me on The Breakfast Grill this morning was Tim Harford, author of the recently published book, How to Make the World Add Up. I'm Wong Xiaoning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.